Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we take a trip back to 1981.
Hey, Patrick.
No, wait a minute. Hang on. That doesn't make sense. I go first on this
you
one.
You go first. All right, hang sorry.
On. Nope. I screwed it up, too.
A couple of knuckleheads.
All right. Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we take a trip back to 1981.
Hey, Patrick. Who was president in 1981?
That's easy. Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan? The actor?
That was okay. Good.
Okay, Patrick, we're going to take a little journey back in time again.
Excellent.
Today. This is very exciting. This is like Back to the Future Part 2. We get to revisit
That's right.
those good times we had. So a while back, on one of our patron episodes, we featured Eric Lorenz. He's here again today. And he had this great topic idea, which was he focused in on four bands who had debut albums in 1980, specifically 1980 debut albums. And it was really interesting because they were really great records, you know, and it was like, how
Amazing.
Did this happen? It's just, it was so cool. So then it's, you know, his number comes up again and it's time for his next patron episode. And he suggests this follow-up. So I'll let him explain what that is here. The show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And please welcome Eric Lorenz.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hey, Eric. Good to talk to you.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. Things are starting to open up a little bit here in Illinois. Everybody's still being cautious, but at least there are some places you can go out and eat and so forth, so that's nice.
Yeah. Great to hear. Slowly but surely. Let's hope.
Slowly but surely. More and more people are getting vaccinated, which is important, so that's good.
Very important.
That's the key. How are you feeling about the Big Ten basketball season?
Last I checked, Illinois was ranked number 6, so that's good.
Yeah, they're doing really well.
They're on a little bit of a roll right now. We'll see how it plays out.
I thought you'd be happy about that. So congrats to the Illini on their season so far. Okay.
All right. So as Jim mentioned, this is a sequel to the podcast I did back in October of 2020, episode 969, regarding 1980 debuts. In that episode, I highlighted four albums from 1980 that meant something to me by The Pretenders, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Teardrop Explodes, and U2. And as it happens, all four of those bands released their sophomore albums in 1981, 40 years ago.
That's amazing.
Because I think all four of those sophomore albums are remarkable in one way or another, I thought I'd talk about them.
Great. Love it.
All right.
I love that, too. And I just find that so interesting, the way that lined up. Like, that those four,
right?
And you love those, and then all four of them did their sophomore albums just 1 year later. I mean, I think it says something about the times back then.
That's true. That's true.
Sort of like and how maybe how well received those debut albums were, that they had to get something out the next year, but still that they all did it. That's kind of amazing. Okay, so
amazing.
So what are those sophomore albums?
I think more revenue to be made from physical product rather than other means.
Totally. Sure. Totally. And I'm sure they were on the road a lot, too, so they needed something new at that point. Yeah.
Okay, so the first album I want to talk about is Pretenders 2, which was released in August of 1981. This was probably the most high... There it is. Patrick's got it. Got a little album wear on the cover from being...
It certainly does. I've had... This one's been with me for a long time. It's got the ring wear from being with the other ones.
All right. So this, I think, was probably the most highly anticipated of the four follow-ups. The two lead singles, Message of Love and Talk of the Town, were released in the U.S. in March of 1981 on the EP Extended Play, so even more product out there.
Yeah.
And those two songs had previously been released as singles in the U.K. The album received mixed critical reviews upon release, probably because two of the better songs on the album had been previously released, and also because several songs were viewed as too similar to the band's debut. They also even included another Ray Davis cover, I Go to Sleep, to match the cover of Stop Your Sobbing on the debut. The album starts strongly with the 1-2 punch of The Adulteress and Bad Boys Get Spanked, leading up to the single Message of Love. Other tracks on side one include I Go to Sleep and the other lead single, Talk of the Town. Side two is not as consistently great, but it has some standout tracks, including Pack It Up, Day After Day, a song about life on the road as a touring band, and then a personal favorite of mine, The English Roses. Ultimately, I think Pretenders 2 is best viewed as a very strong album that had the misfortune of following a stone cold classic that it could never measure up to, much less surpass. Another thing to keep in mind is that this is the last album to feature the original lineup that recorded the debut, because Pete Farndon was dismissed from the band in 1982, only to die in 83, and James Honeyman Scott passed away the same week that Farndon was dismissed. So, that's my summary of Pretenders 2. What do you guys think?
Well, I think you said it very well in that it's a very strong album. If this had been their first album, people would be like, wow, this is pretty great. But it had the misfortune of following an even better album, right? Yep. I think that's, you know, often the case with the sophomore albums, right? There's even from a really good band, they'll put out a strong second effort, but you feel like it's maybe just a notch down from the first one for a lot of reasons that we've, I'm sure, talked about before, about how much time you have to do that first one, and then the second one is often kind of rushed. But I will say, I think you hit some really good high points here. Yep. I just think, like, a song like Message of Love, for example, to me is like, that's like Pretenders canon. You know what I mean? That's like such a essential track. Now the visitor here, as man and woman, is to love each other, take care of each other. When love walks in the room, everybody stand up. Like Brigitte Bardot. Now look at the people in the streets, in the bars. We are all of us in the gutter. Some of us are looking at the stars. Look round the room. Life is unkind. We fall, but we keep getting up. Over and 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 over. Me and you, every night, every day. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this, Patrick? Did you get this at the time? Because I got into Pretenders with the next album. The third one was Learning to Crawl, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's when I got into them. So anyway.
I can't remember. I think I may have gotten it around the time it came out, but maybe not. I don't know. I think it's probably unclear. I know that's an original copy of the it was on Sire in the U.S. That right? So
which was a really cool label, by the way.
Yes. Anyway, exactly.
It's kind of amazing. Yeah.
But I mean, I think what Eric's noted about this being the, you know, really when you think about that original lineup, you know, that's that special lineup of the Pretenders and the contributions that all four members made versus after that, where it sort of became much more focused on Chrissy Hynde, right? And it was people kind of playing with her, and it was clear that, you know, it was her backup band. I think there was a lot that original lineup brought to when they put the songs together. I mean, the songs are darker, and overall they're not as I don't know if I would say punk tinged, but they're not quite as I don't know. They don't sneer quite as much, right? Yep. as they do on the first album, but it's rich. And I think there's a lot to be appreciated with it. And I think it's, I don't know, to me, I always keep those first two together as a pair, right? You know, they really counterbalance each other in a lot of ways. I kind of think of it as one, and again, because they came out so close to each other, it's really a piece to me. That's, I always think of those two right together.
I think that's a good way to look at it. That it's just kind of a continuation, in some ways, you know, and it's even just, it's Pretenders too, right? So, you know, and they drop that later. So it's like, they do kind of, over time, they do sort of like feel like they just belong together, those first two albums.
Yeah, I mean, you really could play them, you know, if it was a double, side one through side four, and it would work, you know, as an evolution. That's kind of the way I feel about it. I mean, I guess I wouldn't want to have to pick between the two. I really wouldn't want one without the other. So to me, it's that whole first block of what they did before they, you know, evolved into the next step.
Yeah.
Probably equally as well known would be U2's second album, October, released in October of 81. Now, this ended up being a challenging album for U2 to record. While they recorded October at the same studio as Boy in Windmill Lane in Dublin, and with Steve Lillywhite still as producer, Bono had lost a briefcase containing lyrics he was working on for the new songs. So he had to improvise by writing new lyrics at the microphone while they were recording. And since they had not yet made their multi-millions, they felt the pressure of having to do that while on studio time. The lyrics on the album contain religious and spiritual themes inspired by a Christian group, the Shalom Fellowship, where Bono, The Edge, and Larry Mullen Jr. were members. Their membership in this Christian group caused them to question their rock and roll lifestyle and threatened to break up the band. I seem to remember some coverage in Rolling Stone about this issue around that time. Some of the songs reflecting the religious and spiritual themes include Gloria, Rejoice, Fire, Tomorrow, and With a Shout, Paren Jerusalem. Sonically, October does include several guitar albums that typified U2's early albums, such as Gloria Again, Rejoice, With a Shout, and Is That All? The album also expands their musical palette with the use of piano on several songs, such as I Fall Down, Stranger in a Strange Land, Scarlet, and October. Larry Mullen's drums are featured prominently on songs like I Threw a Brick Through a Window, especially With a Shout and Is That All? And the lead-off track for Side 2, Tomorrow, even features Ilian pipes and Bowran, two traditional Irish instruments. Critically speaking, I think this is perceived as a middle-of-the-road U2 album, but of their early albums, I think it's the one I've spent the most time with. When I listened to the album in preparation for this episode, I was surprised at how well I remembered the flow from song to song.
That's really interesting that you say that too, Eric, because when I listened to it, I could barely remember any of the songs. I was like, I don't think I listened to this one very much. I did remember the title track. And for some reason, I'm glad you mentioned I Threw a Brick Through a Window, because I do remember that drum part, which is really distinctive in that song. That sort of came back to me, but picking up on what Jim said about the Pretenders, I mean, I didn't know U2 at all until I heard Sunday Bloody Sunday. That was the first U2 song I ever heard, and when the War album came out, got way into that, and it was probably a while later before I even, you know, came across October, because everybody would be like, oh, the other album is I Will Follow, you got to get that album, you know, and so that was Boy, and this one always, it's unusual to me, and I like what you were saying about the pressure. I mean, now you think of U2 as like, you know, they could spend 4 months in the studio right. and it's their own studio or right. something. But right. for them to even have to worry about,
right.
you know, how much an hour it was or whatever, that seems wild to me. It really does. That seems like definitely a completely different millennium or something like that. It really does. It's hard to wrap your mind around.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. It's weird, man.
That they were once a scrappy young, you know, rock
I know.
Band, right?
Like yeah. it's just, how could that be possible?
I know. It is kind of funny. I think this, to me, I'm with you, Patrick. I got into U2 with the War album and then went back and got Boy. And this one never quite felt essential. October never quite felt essential to me. Like, I'm sure I have had it. I don't even think I have a copy now. In fact, I kind of remember once a cassette getting eaten in a tape deck. I think it was October, and I think I didn't replace it. So it's probably one of those albums that, like, the real fans find, like, super interesting, right? Like, you know, because it's something, probably because it does speak to, like, where the band was at that time and that sort of transition, right? It seems like a very much a classic sort of transitional album where they're going from point A, which sort of captured everyone's attention, to like C, which was like where they blow up, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the one sort of in the middle, right? But if you're a fan, or, you know, I would probably suggest, you know, if you're just a fan of rock music or 80s music, whatever, it's probably worth exploring, because there's probably some really interesting stuff in there that I should go back and myself and listen to, because I'm sure there's some gems to be mined.
Yeah, I mean, you know, listening to it this morning before we were recording this episode, we're recording on a Sunday early, late Sunday morning, but at least here on the East Coast, but put it on this morning and, you know, like I said, it was a totally different experience. I mean, obviously it's U2, right? Because you can tell by the instruments and the voice and all that, but it feels weird. It feels foreign. It was kind of a neat experience. Mm. It really was. And I'm guessing I didn't... you know, I didn't really listen to it a ton when it came out. And I'm looking here, too, on Discogs, the site where I probably spend, 80% of my internet time. But the original copies are not cheap. They don't come cheap at all. So I guess it has, you know, been pretty treasured. I don't know, how it's been reissued or anything like that. But it's interesting. Although you can pick the cassettes up pretty cheap, Jim. So you might be able to
replace that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's good to know.
All right. The third album I wanted to talk about is Wilder by the Teardrop Explodes, released in November of 1981. In contrast to the Pretenders and U2, where second albums feature the same band members and the same primary producer, the Teardrop Explodes went through several lineup changes and stylistic shifts between their first and second albums. In addition, Clive Langer took over as producer of the entire album after producing only a few songs on the debut Kilimanjaro. This album is not as straightforward as Kilimanjaro, and it definitely features more psychedelic influences and a greater role for David Balfe on keyboards. The most straightforward and best-known song on Wilder is probably Passionate Friend, but even then, that song has a little psychedelic flair to it. Mm-hmm. There are some high-energy songs like Colors Fly Away and Pure Joy, but Wilder generally seems more subdued overall compared to Kilimanjaro. Julian Cope's presence, although he wrote all the songs, his presence is definitely toned down. One review I read said that it sounds like Cope is just singing along with the melodies rather than acting as a lead singer. Some of the more subdued but still strong songs include Seven Views of Jerusalem, Falling Down Around Me, Tiny Children, and The Fighting Takes Over, and The Great Dominions, which is my favorite song on the album. Like October, this album was not as well received critically as the debut. In my view, however, I think the songs on Wilder are as consistently good as on Kilimanjaro, but the album just emphasizes different aspects of the neo-psychedelic sound.
Very interesting band, I think, as we touched on last time, too. And this is probably the one of these four that I know the least about.
Even though
I'm really interested in Julian Cope, and I think he's such a fascinating figure. Just doing a little prep, and digging around here and there about this album. I mean, this one really seems like the classic case of, a British band had a successful debut album. They were on a pretty big label, at least a label that was big enough to be able to send them out on a U.S. tour. And then when they got to the United States and started playing, everything kind of fell apart, you know, and like they weren't maybe as strong of a unit, or maybe Julian Cope's personality was a lot stronger than was anticipated at first. But, you know, that they kind of put it together on the fly. And he definitely went in a very certain direction. And I don't know if I don't know. It almost seems to me like there's two kind of different visions happening, right? Maybe Julian's vision, and then, you know, the keyboardist, I guess, David Balfe, I guess, was his main collaborator when they were putting this album together. But, you know, it's interesting. And that whole Liverpool psychedelic scene is kind of fascinating. To me, it really gets the flavor of what that is. Like, if you've ever heard about, you know, that neo-psychedelia, you know, scene that happened around the dawn of the 80s in Liverpool, you know, very, very different from what happened in Manchester. This is a great example of what that sounds like to me. You know, from what I've listened to, what I've read, the flavor is really all over this record. And yeah, you know, Passionate Friend, that's the song that totally jumped out at me as me kind of remembering. About you, Jim, if you've spent much time with it. Yeah,
I don't really know much about this album at all, so I'm just fascinated listening to you guys.
Yeah, it's it's very interesting. I mean, I think, as I said on the first edition of this, or part one, kind of, if we're calling it that, a totally underrated band. I mean, if you don't know the Teardrop Explodes, you're missing a big part of what that English quote-unquote new wave or second wave was.
Yeah, I remember back in the early to mid-90s, I put together a mixtape, Best of Teardrop Explodes and Julian Cope, and I would play it with my kids in the car as we were on road trips. And so they got to learn and appreciate some of these songs. My son, one of his favorite was Tiny Children, and then some of the songs from their follow-up, which was really... I think it had been recorded, but not released at the time. It wasn't released until the early 90s.
Yeah.
Everybody Wants to Shag the Teardrop Explode. So, I think it's good to view them in conjunction with at least Julian Cope's career, say, through the early 90s, because that is somewhat of a piece, although even then Julian was releasing a lot of experimental albums that probably had a very limited sales numbers.
Yeah, I would say so, too. I mean, and that's the other thing. He has become, you know, also kind of the definition of a cult artist as well. So, and with all the stuff he does now with, you know, his music writing and curating all these, you know, different kind of things, and being an expert in all these totally bizarre and unknown bands, psychedelic in many cases, makes it interesting. But it's where it all began. I mean, the roots of it are all right here. So it's, I don't know, it feels so 80s to me. I love it. It makes me happy. I mean, just to look at that cover where he's got his hands like that, it takes me back to a time for sure.
It's definitely a good nostalgia trip if you're, you know, if you're feeling like you want to hear something from that vein.
Yeah, good point.
All right, the fourth album is Heaven Up Here by Echo and the Bunnymen. This was released in May of 81. Of the four albums I'm discussing today, this is the only one I didn't buy around the time it came out. I was familiar with the lead single, A Promise, from the compilation Songs to Learn and Sing, but I didn't pick up the full album until more than 30 years later. And that's kind of ironic to me because I think this album got the most critical attention of the four albums we're talking about, with the possible exception of Pretenders 2. And ordinarily, that would have gotten my attention, too. For example, NME gave this album the Best Album and Best Dressed LP Awards for 1981.
Wow.
Sonically, this album retains some of the psychedelic influences from the first album, but by and large, it veers more towards post-punk. I agree with NME's assessment that this is darker and more passionate than their debut, Crocodiles. I'd also say the production is fuller and the music is on a grander scale. Side one of the album starts strongly, with the first three songs being Show of Strength, With the Hip, and Over the Wall. And side one ends with the single I mentioned, A Promise. The album also closes strong, with the last four songs on side two being All My Colors, a.k.a. Zimbo, No Dark Things, Turquoise Days, and All I Want. In contrast to The Teardrop Explodes, Echo and the Bunnymen maintain their focus on guitar, bass, and drums rather than incorporating any keyboards. That being said, All My Colors also does incorporate some woodwinds. So this album would have been right up my alley when it came out in mid-1981, and I'm surprised I didn't pick it up earlier.
Hmm. When did you first get into them?
I picked up Crocodiles probably, I think, late 1980 or early 81.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed that album. But again, my limited musical budget and... I guess I felt like Crocodiles was enough of a neo-psychedelic statement for my record collection that I didn't venture off and buy Heaven Up Here.
What about you, Jim? When did you get into them?
Well, I think the first song was probably, because they had a video for The Cutter on MTV. That was probably the first time I heard Echo and the Bunnymen was that song. And then, but they're not one of those bands that I like... got super into for some reason. I kind of know them superficially, which is unfortunate because, like you're saying, I'm reading about how this is considered one of the, according to Rolling Stone, one of the 500 greatest albums of all time, and I didn't know that. So now I need to know, right?
And Jim, with your appreciation of post-punk, I think you would really
definitely.
Yeah,
I don't know. You're absolutely right. I'm also noting here that David Balfe was also involved with this album. He was one of the producers. So how about that?
There you go. I didn't know that. I mean, they were on Sire too in the United States, so you know it kind of fits with that kind of sound, that I think was they were going for. And similar to, I mean, to me, I think of those first three albums, the first three Echo and the Bunnymen albums, as kind of a piece of what their early kind of sound was, because I think the third one was Porcupines for sure, and then. Ocean Rain is the fourth one, and that one had like an orchestra or something on it. But like you were saying, Eric, there are touches here and there of where eventually they were going to go. This one's great. I mean, they're it's like I was thinking talking about like with the Pretenders. The first three, I feel like they're all kind of there together. I'm pretty sure I had made a mixtape that was maybe one side of a 45-minute tape that had like songs from all three of these albums that I had for a long time and played. Like I said, these were on Sire, and they were always available. Like I remember, from my time working in record stores, it was easy to like listen to them or, you know, pick them up with your employee discount or something like that. So I remember having all of them. Although, strangely enough, I'm looking on Discogs here on my account and Heaven Appears on my want list. So at some point, I either sold it or lent it to somebody or lost it. I don't know what happened, but it is one of those ones that's got the little red dot that I need to get a copy of to replace my collection. I've got the others except for this one, so that's kind of interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't have the vinyl because I picked it up so much later. So,
yeah.
My trajectory with Echo and the Bunnymen was got the first album around the time it came out, and then I think 84 or 85 was when they released Bring On the Dancing Horses.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a soundtrack, and I'm not sure which one as I sit here.
And I saw them around that time, too, when that was pretty popular. There was a, I don't know if we've talked about this much, Jim, but there was a alternative station there used to be in D.C. called WHFS, right? And used to actually be a really good station back in the late 80s and early 90s. And that's, they used to play Echo and the Bunnymen all the time.
Is that right?
Yep. But I remember I saw Echo and the Bunnymen was at the top of the bill, Aztec Camera in the middle, and Guadalcanal Diary was on the bottom. It was a great show.
Sounds like it.
My friend Andy was there. But I want to say like 86, 87, something like that.
Yeah, so I heard that song on the radio, and I picked up their greatest hits, Songs to Learn and Sing.
Right.
And then a little bit later, I picked up the eponymous one that has Lips Like Sugar. And then some 30 years later, I felt a gaping hole in my collection for Echo and the Bunnymen, so I picked up the second, third, and fourth one to kind of fill in that.
Got it.
Perfect.
That, so.
I mean, that Greatest Hits compilation is killer. That Songs to Learn and Sing is an amazing nonstop. And yeah, it looks like Bring On the Dancing Horses was recorded for Pretty in Pink.
That's right. Really?
John Hill. Yep, that's what it says here on the intranets. So that's interesting.
Yes.
Can't remember it really being in the movie.
But. I don't know either, but that is a good soundtrack, that album.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know where it shows up there either. It's actually not a very good movie. But anyway, the music in that movie's good. But yeah, you know, the interesting thing you said there, Patrick, and maybe this is my problem, is when a band puts out like a really good greatest hits, I don't always feel the need to then go explore their individual albums so much, you know, and I think that was the case with this band, you know.
Great point. So, absolutely. And that was a thing, you know, that greatest hits was like a staple. I mean, I remember a lot of my friends having that. You go to a party or something and that would be playing, you know, that was a key one.
I think for a lot of American listeners, that just became their signature album,
kind of,
you know?
Yep, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Every track is like really excellent.
And especially when it isn't called Greatest Hits too, you just sort of feel like, well, this is the album. You know? That's right. Yeah.
That's true.
It's like singles going steady or that kind of thing, right?
You know,
it just becomes the one you equate with the band, right?
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, speaking of Pretty in Pink, I'll close out this topic by just mentioning a few more sophomore albums that came out in 1981.
Okay.
The first two are actually bands that we mentioned on the on part one of this. Talk, Talk, Talk by the Psychedelic Furs, which has Pretty in Pink on it, and then Wild Gift by X. Gang of Four released Solid Gold, and they could have qualified, except that Entertainment was released in 79, not 80.
Ah.
And then last and probably least, Get Lucky by Loverboy. I think Loverboy got mentioned in the previous episode, so we have to give them a nod.
Okay. Well, this is great. What a great topic.
Again, I know. Love it. I can't wait to see what happens in 1982.
I don't think the pattern probably doesn't hold, does it?
Nobody can hold up.
I think it falls apart, so...
Yeah.
This is a 2-and-over topic.
Well, thanks very much, Eric. This has been a great conversation.
Love
revisiting these years. It's so much fun. And I got some more listening to do. So.
Yeah. Teardrop explodes, Jim.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
Sure.
Got to report back.
Okay. All right. If anyone would like to be a patron of the show like Eric, go to patreon.com/suburbspod. If anyone would like to comment on these bands or these albums or this particular year? What were you listening to then, or what have you discovered from 1980, 1981? Mm-hmm. We'd love to hear about it. So what you do there is you call and leave a message on our voice machine. It's 612-440-1984. There you go. Or email rock@suburbspod.com, or go to Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, as long as they'll have us at Suburbs Pod. All right.
That's right. We haven't been booted yet.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Well, we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Eric.
That sounds good.
All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Eric Lorenz.
All right. We'll talk to you all later.
You know, the hair that Adam Clayton has going on the cover.
Now that's a statement in itself.
Yeah. It really is. Yeah, just boom, sticking out there.